Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the October 14th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It took 5 days for President Obama to acknowledge and apologize to Doctors Without Borders for the U.S. having targeted and intentionally bombed the organization's hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan. He had less than a day for him to accuse Russia of not having bombed Daesh or the Islamic State, but the anti-government groups in Syria that the U.S. has been supporting. The most prominent of them, the al-Nusra Front, happens to be that country's al-Qaeda franchise and the favorite of Washington's Saudi Arabia allies, which is arming it to the teeth with weapons purchased from the U.S. You remember al-Qaeda. If my memory serves me correctly, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan following the destruction of the New York World Trade Center in 2001, which it blamed on al-Qaeda in order to destroy it, and supporting al-Qaeda has been the excuse for maintaining the U.S. prison in Guantanamo. It should be noted that both the Kurds in Syria, who Washington supports, and the government of Iraq have welcomed Russian intervention in Syria. Meanwhile, in Turkey, the F-16s, provided by Washington so the Erdogan regime could attack the Islamic State, have been used instead to attack Kurdish forces in Iraq. Until recently, Turkey cooperated with the Islamic State, allowing scores of foreign jihadists to cross its frontier with Syria unhindered, while Washington looked the other way. It was an essential factor in the Islamic State's growth and its successes. This past Saturday saw another attack on the Kurds, this time in Ankara, where over 100 people, most of them Kurds, gathering for a peace march outside the train station of Turkey's second-largest city, were killed, and several hundred injured when two suicide bombers detonated their explosives. The government blamed the deadly blast on the Islamic State, but thus far no group has taken credit. Further south, Israelis and Palestinians appear to be on the brink of a third intifada. A spate of extrajudicial killings and shootings by the Israeli military of unarmed protesters, attacks by Israeli settlers that have gone unpunished, and the ongoing failure of the Palestinian Authority to do anything to defend them has led to individual Palestinians taking matters into their own hands and attacking Israelis, even when doing so risk almost certain death. I'll have more to say about this in a few moments, but I want to let you know that at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be exploring something closer to home, what's happening in post-Chavez Venezuela, how one of the world's most oil-rich countries is fast becoming an economic disaster under Chavez's successor, Nicolas Maduro. My guests will be Pedro Lange Chauvion, chair of the Department of Latin American Studies at the University of San Francisco, so stay tuned for that. On my last program, I interviewed our Professor Alfred McCoy about President Obama's strategy for extending the shelf life of the American global empire by enacting true trade pacts that would exclude Washington's main economic rival, China, from 40% of the global economy. The first is the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership, for which the Senate, with Republican support, voted to give him fast track without amendments when it comes up for a final approval in February. The TPP took a giant leap forward in Atlanta a week ago Monday when the 12 Pacific Rim countries that formed the pact voted to approve it. The second pact, the so-called Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, between Europe and the United States and Canada, will be a harder sell. On Saturday, at least 150,000 people marched in Berlin in protest against the planned free trade deal between Europe and the United States that they say is anti-democratic and will lower food safety, labor, and environmental standards. The organizers, an alliance of environmental groups, charities, and opposition parties, claim that 250,000 people had taken part in the rally, far more than they had anticipated. The lower figure of 150,000 was the estimate of the police. But there was general agreement this was the biggest protest that Germany had seen for many years. Well, the Associated Press caught Hillary Clinton revising her history when the subject of the TPP came up in last night's debate. According to the AP story, quote, Hillary Rodham Clinton offered some revisionist history Tuesday night when insisting she's not a flip-flopper on a trade deal that she heartily promoted as Secretary of State but turned against last week as a Democratic presidential candidate. I did say, quote, I hope it would be the gold standard of trade agreements, she said of the Trans-Pacific Partnership when asked about her changing positions in the Democratic presidential debate. Actually, Clinton did not say anything about hope in her many speeches around the world in support of the trade deal. On November 15, 2012, in Adelaide, Australia, she said, quote, "This TPP sets the gold standard in trade agreements to open free, transparent, fair trade, the kind of environment that has the rule of law and a level playing field," end quote. According to the article, she pitched the deal in Vietnam, Washington, and beyond without qualification. Clinton said in the debate that when she looked at the final agreement last week, quote, "it didn't meet my standards." The final agreement, however, noted the AP, dropped or changed some provisions that liberal activist groups, the wing of the party she is assiduously courting at this stage of the campaign, had strongly criticized. For example, the U.S. had pushed for 12 years of legal protection from generic drugs for advanced pharmaceuticals, but the final agreement provides only up to 8 years. A provision was also added barring tobacco companies from using the agreement to overturn national anti-smoking laws. Then the latest flare-up between the Israelis and Palestinians might be said to have begun on September 22nd, when a young Palestinian woman died of her wounds after being shot at least 8 times by Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint on the West Bank, which was captured on a video that went viral. The Israeli army said that 19-year-old Hadil Salah al-Hashlamon attempted to stab a soldier, who in turn fired live ammunition at her, quote, lower extremities. But the video that emerged later showed that al-Hashlamon was shot several times at a distance, including in the chest, and there was no evidence that she was holding a knife or even carrying one. Amnesty International said the death of al-Hashlamon was one, quote, "in a long line of unlawful killings carried out by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank with near total impunity," end quote. Since then, there have been a number of similar incidents which have been largely unreported in the U.S. These have led to individual Palestinians launching attacks against Israelis in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which now has Netanyahu and other Israeli officials condemning the U.N. and the world for not speaking out about the deaths of Israelis. Since the beginning of the latest wave of violence in East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank, 23 Palestinians have been killed and 1,991 injured by Israeli security forces, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. On the Israeli side, as of last weekend, 4 Israelis have been stabbed to death by Palestinians, while 63 others were injured. As Israel intensified its violence and the apparently uncoordinated daily attacks were being carried out by Palestinians, youth in Gaza began marching to its barbed-wire borders to express solidarity and their frustration. On Sunday, Israeli soldiers in full combat gear shot protesters and fired tear gas canisters into the crowd of an estimated 1,000 young men and boys, killing 7 and injuring 145 along Gaza's border area. Layers of barbed wire and open space separated the soldiers from the protesters, who threw rocks they found on the ground and Molotov cocktails. According to reports, dirt mounds protected Israeli snipers as they picked off one protester after another with Ruger 22 rifles, hitting them in the head, chest, abdomen, and limbs. At no point did the protesters present any threat to the heavily armed soldiers. At least one protester reportedly managed to plant a flag on the barbed wire. A Human Rights Watch spokesperson told Al Jazeera that the sheer number of cases of injuries among the Palestinians, quote, "raises concerns that Israeli forces are violating international law," end quote. If representatives from our news channels or our national media had asked for Human Rights Watch comments on the situation, they would no doubt receive the same response. But they didn't, because they've learned that what can and cannot be told to the American public about the Israel-Palestine conflict, which is the truth. And noticeably, it was not raised in last night's Democratic debate. The most powerful, eloquent analysis of what has been happening there was made a week ago today by Haaretz's Amir Haas, the veteran Israeli journalist who lives in the West Bank. It is worth quoting her article in length because what she writes would not be published in any American newspaper or heard elsewhere on American media. "Yes, this is a war," she begins, "and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with his mandate from the people, has ordered his intensification. He does not listen to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, the messages of conciliation and acceptance in calmer times. Why should he listen to them now? Netanyahu is intensifying the war mainly in East Jerusalem with orgies of collective punishment. He thus further reveals, Mirahas goes on, Israel's success in physically disconnecting Jerusalem from most of the Palestinian population, accenting the absence of Palestinian leadership in East Jerusalem and the weakness of the government in Ramallah, which is trying to stop the drift in the rest of the West Bank. The war did not start last Thursday, she writes. It does not start with the Jewish victims and does not end when no Jews are murdered. The Palestinians are fighting for their life, she writes, in the full sense of the word. We Israeli Jews are fighting for our privilege as a nation of masters, in the full ugliness of the term. That we notice there's a war on only when Jews are murdered does not cancel out the fact that Palestinians are being killed all the time, and that all the time we are doing everything in our power to make their lives unbearable. Most of the time, it's a unilateral war waged by us to get them to say to the master, thank you very much for keeping us alive in our reservations. When something in the war's one-sidedness is disturbed, Amirahas writes, and Jews are murdered, then we pay attention. Young Palestinians do not go out to murder Jews because they are Jews, but because we are their occupiers, their torturers, their jailers, the thieves of their land and water, their exilers, the demolishers of their homes, the blockers of their horizon. Young Palestinians, she goes on, vengeful and desperate, are willing to lose their lives and cause their families great pain because the enemy they face proves every day that its malice has no limits. Even the language is malicious. Jews are murdered, Palestinians are killed and die. Is that so? The problem doesn't begin with our not being permitted to write that a soldier or police officer murdered Palestinians at close range when his life was not in danger or by remote control or from a place or a drone. But it is part of the problem, says Amirahas. Our comprehension is captive to a retroactively censored language that distorts reality. In our language, Jews are murdered because they are Jews, and Palestinians find their death and their distress because presumably that's what they're looking for. Our worldview is shaped by the consistent betrayal by Israeli media outlets of their duty to report events or their lack of the technical and the emotional ability to contain all the details of the world war that we are conducting in order to preserve our superiority in the land between the river and the sea. Not even this newspaper, writes Mirahas, has the economic resources to employ 10 reporters and fill 20 pages with reports on all the attacks in times of escalation and all the attacks of the occupation in times of calm, from shooting through a building, a road that destroys a village, to legalizing a settlement outpost and a million more assaults every day. The random examples we do manage to report are but a drop in the ocean, writes Amirahas, and they have no impact on the comprehension of the situation for a large majority of Israelis. The goal of this unilateral war is to force the Palestinians to give up all their national demands in their homeland. Netanyahu wants escalation because experience so far has proved that the periods of calm after the bleeding returns us not to the starting line, but rather to a new low in the Palestinian political system and adds privileges to the Jews in greater Israel. Privileges are the chief factor that distorts our understanding of our reality, blinding us, writes Amirahas. Because of them, we fail to comprehend that even with weak, present absent leadership, the Palestinian people scattered in its Indian reservations will not give up and will continue to find the strength necessary to resist our malicious mastership. End quote. Those are the words of Amirahas, the brave Israeli journalist, writing in Haaretz October 7th. Her fellow journalist at Haaretz, Gideon Levy, another brave soul, who I have cited before, predicted, quote, that to the extent that the indifferent world does not bestir itself and take notice only because there is violence, It will, rather than do anything principled and useful to end the occupation, simply urge both sides to restore calm and return to negotiations without preconditions. That is, call upon the Palestinian leadership to resume running pointlessly on the hamster wheel of the perpetual peace process, which has been designed to perpetuate and intensify the occupation while permitting the international community, quote-unquote, to be comfortable while doing nothing principled or useful, end quote. Gideon Levy and Haaretz. Would we had journalists like that in the United States. Well, sure enough, in his own paper on Sunday was the headline, "Kerry to Netanyahu and Abbas, Act to Reinstate Calm in West Bank, Jerusalem." And Reuters reports that Secretary of State John Kerry said yesterday he plans to travel to the Middle East to try to calm violence between Palestinians and Israelis and move the situation, quote, away from this precipice, end quote. For his part, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu announced Monday that, quote, "At my instruction, the government today will approve legislation for minimum prison sentences for those who throw rocks and firebombs and fines for minors and their parents," end quote. The minimum for throwing rocks would be 4 years. One of the ironies of the current situation in Syria is that while the U.S. refuses to sit down with the Russians to reduce the possibility of the air forces of the two nations accidentally engaging one another, the Russians have already done that with the Israelis, according to Haaretz's military correspondent, Anshul Pfeffer. At the same time, Pfeffer writes that the deconfliction talks of the kind the Americans rejected between the Israel Defense Forces and their Russian counterparts, led by the deputy chief of staff of both militaries, were already wrapping up in Tel Aviv's Hakira headquarters. The fact that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu requested and received a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin immediately when the Russian deployment to Syria began should not come as a surprise. Despite Israel's strategic ties with the United States, Pfeffer notes, both sides have maintained a discreet and intimate security relationship which is much closer than meets the eye. Israel received from Putin in 2008 advance warning of Russia's plans to attack Georgia, which enabled Israel to call back its private defense contractors and advisors who were working at the time with the Georgians. And that's from Anshul Pfeffer and Haaretz. What Pfeffer doesn't mention in the article was that Israel refused to join the U.S. and its NATO allies in condemning Russia's retaking of Crimea, a position that outraged the staunchly anti-Russian neocons who, in deference to their allegiance to Israel and Netanyahu, chose not to make their unhappiness with the Israeli prime minister's position public. Well, if nothing else, the Middle East makes for strange bedfellows.